I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, if studies show that geriatricians are the most satisfied of doctors, the happiest of all as they work with the elderly, then why is there a shortage of geriatricians? But first, embattled Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez was back on Capitol Hill today, facing more congressional questioning on the firing of U.S. attorneys. Critics believe the firings were political. This morning, Gonzalez was grilled by the House Judiciary Committee. The chairman, Michigan Democrat John Conyers, said the committee has collected reams of material during its investigation, but he said a simple question remains. How was the list of fired U.S. attorneys created?
We're perfectly willing to let you see anything you want. We're cooperating, but cooperate with us.
I'm trying, Mr. Chairman.
Seth Stern is a reporter for Congressional Quarterly. He's covering the hearing and has ducked out to speak with us. And Seth, Congressman Conyers at times sounded to us like he was pleading for answers from Gonzalez. Did he get any?
It was pretty much more of the same from the Attorney General. He really stuck to what he said in his appearance last month before the Senate Judiciary Committee. He said mistakes were made and how this was handled. But he stood by the decision to remove and replace the fired U.S. attorneys.
Did Gonzalez say anything, or was he asked anything, about a report in the Washington Post today that another U.S. attorney, this is Todd Graves of Kansas City, Missouri, this other U.S. attorney, Graves, said he was asked to step down by a senior Justice Department official in January 2006. That would be months before eight other federal prosecutors were fired by the Bush administration. Did that come up?
Yeah, it did come up. Democrats asked him about it, and Gonzalez said that as far as he knew, and he was careful in a lot of his answers to add those sort of caveats, as far as he knew, that that was not connected, that was not part of the process by which the other eight were dismissed.
Yeah. What? By the way, what are supporters of Mr. Gonzalez, or more specifically, if this is the case, Republicans saying?
Well, you have some of the Republicans are saying we've done weeks or months of investigation, thousands of pages of documents, dozens of interviews, and you've gotten nothing, that this is sort of an endless fishing expedition. But even here in the House, you have a lot of partisan Republicans, but not a lot of defenders of the Attorney General. A lot of the Republicans just preferred to change the topic entirely and ask him questions about immigration or intellectual property. So you don't see a lot of defenders of the Attorney General.
Well, but given that, though, Seth, we're hearing that analysts are saying that the administration may be pushing to keep Gonzalez, even though he's a punching bag for Democrats, because the administration doesn't want to endure what would surely be a bruising confirmation fight over a new Attorney General, while the Democrats may not actually want to give Gonzalez up as that figurative punching bag, that each side is sort of doing a dance here. Where do you think this is headed?
Well, it seems ever since the Senate appearance, where he really came into criticism from everyone, that he has sort of stood it out. I mean, he stuck it out. He's still here. The White House is firm in its support. And it is true from the Democrats' perspective that as long as he's in place, they can continue to generate a lot of attention and publicity and keep the administration on the defensive. So in some sense, I guess it does serve the purpose of both sides.
Seth Stern, reporter for Congressional Quarterly, speaking to us about today's appearance by Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez before the House Judiciary Committee. Congress, as we said, investigating the firing of eight, possibly nine now, U.S. attorneys. Seth, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Well, we want to take a few minutes today to look at a looming crisis in elder care. Actually, it's already here. It's the lack of geriatricians, physicians trained in the care of older people. The number of older adults is expected to double over the next 25 years, but the number of geriatricians is declining. According to the American Geriatric Society, in 2003, only 62 physicians were in second-year training to be geriatricians nationwide. This, as a study at the University of Minnesota, showed that the elderly who are treated by a geriatrics team live healthier lives than those without. Well, what to do? Well, some hospitals are applying a form of triage, using the few geriatricians there are to train other physicians. A leading innovator is the Boston University School of Medicine at the Boston Medical Center, which has a year-long Chief Resident Immersion Training Program, or CRIT. It culminates in a weekend retreat on Cape Cod here in Massachusetts.
So our management plan is
Over 3 days, chief residents from every medical discipline meet and first of all ask questions. For instance, when might a sleeping pill for the elderly do more harm than good?
A touch of Ativan, and some people will just snow them. So I struggle with that because sometimes I think the bad sleep cycle has gotten them into this state. I don't know sometimes how to break it, you know, without a med.
They also listen to impassioned lectures by experienced geriatricians, in this case, on post-surgery delirium in the elderly.
Delirium was actually associated independently with a 2- to 3-fold increased risk of mortality. Delirium is an independent predictor of death. And perhaps, you know, we've all been taught in medical school that delirium is a transient condition. You find the underlying causes, and people are going to go back to their baseline. Well, unfortunately, perhaps that's not the case.
And the chief residents workshop hypothetical cases. For instance, what to do with an elderly woman who has become delirious after surgery.
Decreased noise, you said, so away from nursing station, because that's where all the talking and yakking is.
Sometimes if the family can't be there 24 hours, having them bring in pictures or something to put in front of her.
Okay, so orienting devices like pictures of the family.
This workshop is run by Dr. Sharon Levine, Director of Medical Education at Boston Medical Center.
Older patients often are complex and challenging with many, many conditions, and it requires collaborative care. An elderly person may have high blood pressure, diabetes, hypertension, glaucoma, hearing loss, pulmonary disease, lung disease, and can't get up from a chair because of arthritis. Everything you do to take care of one problem may have a downstream effect that makes other problems worse. Part of what this is all about is understanding this cascade of events that can happen in these very complex patients.
This brings us back to our hypothetical patient, so agitated after surgery. A surgeon suggests a brain scan. A geriatrician asks, how would you get her into the machine? Another doctor suggests a tranquilizing medication, but yet another wonders, what if she's an alcoholic in withdrawal?
DTs, yes, if they had DTs. Yeah, we don't know if this lady drinks, but I have to say that especially surgeons see this. You know, someone who gets a tib-fib fracture crossing the street, a lot of times those people are intoxicated, but they're a little old lady, so you don't think of them as an alcoholic. So John's point that...
That's Dr. Sharon Levine during Boston Medical Center's last CRIT, or Chief Residents Immersion Training Program. This year's retreat is this weekend, and observers are coming from around the country to learn how to stave off this growing crisis in elder care in their hospitals. And Dr. Sharon Levine joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having me, Robin.
What is the thinking? People might think, well, geez, a surgeon must know how to treat the elderly. What's the issue here?
What we look at is functional independence. We want people to do all the time is not only treat the medical problems they have or surgical problems they have, but to address the functional issues that come along with them. So, for instance, if you have arthritis of your hip or your knee, that's not just arthritis of the hip and knee. It affects your ability to get to the senior center to have a congregate meal, and that affects the quality of life. And so while we're addressing the medical issues and the surgical issues, we're also addressing all of the functional issues, which are physical functionality as well as cognitive functionality. There are many people who have heart failure, congestive heart failure, and they take diuretic medications to make them urinate, which helps keep them relatively dry so that they can breathe well. So you might think about what is the best time of day to give somebody diuretics so that either they're not getting up all night long to go to the bathroom.
And possibly falling.
And possibly falling in, and many people fall on the way to the bathroom in a darkened hallway. Or maybe you don't want to give it during the day because then they can't leave their house because they have to think about going to the bathroom all the time. It can have ultimate effects on more than just their heart.
I was listening to doctors also talk about prescribing sleep medication, which extra thought has to go into that when it comes to the elderly.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, sleep medications are one of the reasons, sedatives are one of the reasons why elderly people fall. And accidents are the 6th or 7th leading cause of death in the elderly. And the vast majority of those are from falls. Kurt Vonnegut being a perfect example just a few weeks ago, having a head injury. So we're thinking about that all the time when we're sending somebody to the bathroom in the middle of the night in a darkened hallway.
And you say also that geriatricians think more about feet. What is it about feet?
I'll just give you an example from my practice yesterday. I made a house call to a patient who lives in Dorchester, and She never has wanted me to look at her feet, but I always tell her I have to look at her feet because she doesn't want to go to a podiatrist. So once again yesterday, I took off her shoes, and her toenails are about 2 inches long, going in every direction, digging into her skin, causing cuts in her skin. When you have feet like that that you can't bend down and you can't wash and get calloused, you're at a risk for fall. So any kind of risk factor that we can modify, and the feet is are surely one of the risk factors that we can modify in older folks, we try and modify. And that's a lot of what we do. If someone can't get up out of a chair, we think about a 6-inch foam cushion that can put them at a better position of arising from a chair. Mm-hmm. If someone's falling on their way to the bathroom, we think about having a nightlight in the hallway or putting yellow reflecting tape across a door threshold or taking out a door threshold. Mm-hmm. So that's the way we think when we think about functionality in older adults. So geriatricians are an interesting, we are part of an interesting specialty because we take care of the sickest of the sick, the frailest of the frail, those who have multiple comorbidities, and where that has an impact on their function, because there's never going to be enough geriatricians to take care of all the people that have heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, arthritis. We can't. Mm-hmm. There are 7,500 of us in the country. There are 35 million people over the age of 65. So what's incumbent upon us as geriatricians is to deliver primary care to the frailest of the frail, but a larger job of what we have to do is to train other people. So, for instance, if you are a rheumatologist and you're seeing somebody that has bad knees or bad hips, it's not only just giving them medication to take care of their bad knees or bad hips, it's sending the nurse in to their house to do a home safety assessment. What would make it easier for them to walk? What's going to make it easier for them to get on and off of a toilet? What's going to make it easier for them to get in and out of a chair? What about having an occupational therapist take care of somebody who's having trouble reaching high shelves in their house? How can they make adjustments? What can a physical therapist do to recommend assistive devices, walkers, wheelchairs, canes? Which is the best one? So to think about the sort of it takes a village approach to take care of multiply disabled older folks.
That's Dr. Sharon Levine of Boston Medical Center talking about the crisis in elder care, not enough geriatricians, even though it should be a growth industry given the fact that so many baby boomers are soon going to be senior citizens. Well, in the New Yorker magazine recently, a researcher was asked, what can be done to ensure that there will be enough geriatricians to treat the surging elder population? He said, nothing. It's too late. Well, Dr. Levine and others don't think it is. What they're trying to do is train other physicians in the many ways that elders need care to think about their special needs. We'll have more with her in a moment about just how they are going about that and why. Why aren't more physicians going into this field? Later on, high gas prices, the brave new world of commercial airlines, even a pillow is going to cost you money. Beware that low fare. There may be fees attached. That's later. Back after a quick break with more from Dr. Sharon Levine here and now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now, and we're back with more of our look at a crisis in healthcare, a shortage of geriatricians, doctors who specialize in caring for the elderly. A few years ago, a study at the University of Minnesota showed that the elderly lived healthier lives and incurred less medical costs when they were treated by geriatricians. Shortly after that study, the university closed the Division of Geriatrics, and other schools have done the same. Why? Well, for one thing, in 2005, Congress cut $32 million in federal funding for training geriatric fellows. That money was just restored by the new Congress, and now researchers are scrambling to write grants. We've been hearing from Dr. Sharon Levine, an innovator in this field and director of education at Boston Medical Center, where geriatricians make house calls and have a full immersion training program to teach doctors from other disciplines the special needs of the elderly. But Dr. Levine, why aren't more medical students interested in choosing this as a specialty?
Geriatrics may not be thought of as sexy by many of those who are training in medical school now. They're very, very much exposed to the procedurally oriented subspecialties.
We've had that interpreted as, you know, people can make more money doing plastic surgery than treating the elderly.
Well, it's just that it's exciting. What I would say is exciting about being a geriatrician, and I'm going to tell you about a study that came out a few years ago that looked at job satisfaction among physicians, the top, not partway down, not second, the top in the highest amount of job satisfaction was geriatric medicine physicians.
Really?
Yes. The top by 2-1 over family medicine.
Well, yeah, I think it would seem, I just want to jump in and say it would seem, too, that you've got a PR problem. Because I'm thinking, for instance, of a recent article written by Atul Gawande in The New Yorker, in which he says that he's being told that, you know, people who are training to be a doctor just, they don't think, it's not only that they don't think it's sexy when they do work with the elderly, they think they're more problematic and they are cranky and they have not just one problem but 15 problems. There's this perception, at least, that it isn't rewarding, and let's face it, it's a profession in which you know your patient doesn't have much longer to live, and that might be wearing on doctors. What are you? Obviously, that's not true. If this study shows that people like you have a tremendous feeling of satisfaction, how do you offset the perception that it's not satisfying?
The smartest docs go into geriatrics. They're incredibly smart. We have the sickest patients. They don't have one disease. They don't have two diseases. They have 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 diseases. They're on 20 medications. Hopefully we can get that down. At Boston University School of Medicine, where I work, medical students have been making house calls since 1875. That's 132 years. And I can tell you this. When I meet alumni from BU School of Medicine, one of the few things they can remember from their medical training is the house calls they made in the Coldwater Flats that are now the multi-million-dollar brownstones in the South End. They remember it. They remember who was there. They remember who the caregivers were. They remember the patients. They remember the circumstances. And it's memorable. And something that's memorable is something that you can sink your teeth into. And I have to say that all people need to do is be exposed to the stories of patients who were in the Negro Leagues or who were famous jazz musicians in the past and listen to the stories to really be wowed by some of these patients who look just like old people but have a history. If you put 25, 80-year-olds in a room, that's a very exciting room that has a lot to tell you. And once you expose people to that, I think that they can see it.
Have you seen moments where you see a light go off, where they get it, they get geriatrics, where something happens for a doctor that you're trying to help be more conscious of how to work with the elderly?
I'll tell you a couple of interesting anecdotes. I had an intern a few years ago who was going into they spend a year in internal medicine and they spend time on the inpatient wards. He was going into emergency medicine. And I said, when you have an old patient in the emergency room, before you send them home, make sure you can see how they walk. Make sure they can walk. This was a resident who, an intern who was, you know, liked to tussle and, you know, was challenging. About, I don't know, maybe a year and a half later, I was sitting outside and I ran into him and he said, Dr. Levine, I have to tell you something, you know, now that I'm in the ER, I never let anybody go out of that emergency room before I see if they can walk. And I thought, yes, yes.
It's making them pay much more attention to their patients when they're looking for that in the elderly patient.
Yes, and everybody has an old grandma or an old aunt. If you can pull them back and get them sort of not thinking as doctors sometimes, but as thinking as family members and caregivers, because that's what we all are in addition to being physicians, they can relate to it in that way. There are many, many doctors who go into geriatrics because they had these marvelous relationships with their grandparents. And so when they see them start to fail and then experience the medical system themselves and see how it does an injustice, by focusing only on the medical stuff. We have to focus on the medical stuff. I'm not saying that. That's why I said geriatricians are smart, because we're dealing with all of the medical problems. We have a canvas that we've painted this very complex social and functional background on, and we superimpose all of these medical problems onto that canvas of function and social issues and who are their caregivers and are their caregivers. If I'm a surgeon and I'm sending somebody home to put eye drops in their eyes, if I'm an ophthalmologist and somebody's had cataract surgery and they have to put drops in their eyes 5 times a day and there is nobody there, who's going to do that? So it's a matter of just sort of thinking the next step about whether people can do that, or if they're demented and you give them eye drops and they put them in their mouth, that's not going to be very helpful either.
Right.
So I think we can get people to recognize this. And the other thing I think we can do is to get these doctors to all talk to one another, because we all deal with patients who have multiple problems. And one patient, as I mentioned earlier, can have several specialists. I don't think it's the greatest thing to have 5 million specialists, especially if there's no primary care doctor to orchestrate this. But if you do, they have to find a way to talk to one another. I'm doing this. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm doing this. How is it going to affect what you're doing?
How is it going to affect what you're doing and not work in a vacuum?
Dr. Sharon Levine is director of the Boston Medical Center's Geriatric Fellowship Program. Dr. Levine, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I always look for a chance to proselytize.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, they were champion racers, war heroes, and sadly, table fare. Pigeons, perhaps our most beloved and reviled bird. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, should you be taxed for gas to make you use less? After the news, Here and Now.
Support.
Young, it's Here and Now. Gas prices are hovering at record levels, around $3.05 per gallon, and they're likely to get even higher this summer. Gas tends to be more expensive in the summer when demand increases as people get in cars and head off on vacation. But this year's spike is higher and started sooner than usual. Some analysts fear that prices could reach $4 a gallon or more. Well, our next guest says, good. He thinks the price of gas should be high, and instead of passing laws to keep the cost down, there should be laws to keep it up. Vahan Janjigian is vice president of the Forbes Investor Advisory Institute, a frequent guest on Here and Now. Vahan, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
So you're one of those guys who says keep the price high, so what? So Americans will be less likely to use gas frivolously?
Well, exactly. I mean, we've seen the price of gasoline go through $3 per gallon now for the third time. And the first two times that happened, we actually saw a marginal cutback in demand. However, every time that happens, we see the price fall again. Suddenly, everybody notices that the price is cheap, at least compared to the recent past, and they start filling up the cars and driving again. So
right.
We need to keep the price at a level to discourage people from driving too much.
Well, you are suggesting this floor on gas prices. Others are suggesting a cap on how high it should go. You're saying a cap on how low it should go, literally. How would that work?
That's right. You put a floor on the price of gasoline, let's say $3, and if the market price of gasoline were to drop below that, you would still charge $3 per gallon, and the difference would be used for something. It would be a kind of a tax that the government would collect. Now, what it's used for really makes a difference. My view is that it should either be used to offset other taxes, or it should be used to fund alternative technologies.
Well, people already think that gas companies are gouging. Why wouldn't they, if they knew that there was a floor, why wouldn't they artificially keep prices high?
Well, the gas companies really aren't gouging, and the price of gasoline is really determined by futures traders. You can track the futures price very carefully, and the retail price is equal to the futures price plus the taxes, plus the marketing, plus the distribution costs. So we can, just by looking at the futures price, we can get a good idea of what the retail price of gasoline should be.
The futures price is sort of the bet of what the price is going to be down the road.
That's right. And it's determined on an open market with buyers and sellers.
And why, by the way, are gas prices as high as they are? Review that for us.
Okay. Now, in the past, gasoline prices typically spiked when oil prices spiked. This time, it's a little bit different because oil prices really haven't jumped up that much. In fact, they're up only about 10% since the start of the year, but gasoline prices are up about 30%. This time, it's different because it's really tied to refining problems. We have refineries in this country that are very old. The last one was built about 30 years ago. They have to be shut down quite frequently for maintenance. We've had a number of refinery fires recently, and as a result, we've got a shortage of gasoline. In the past, we used to import oil and make our own gasoline. Now we're actually importing gasoline, too, because our refineries can't keep up with the demand.
Your plan of keeping gas prices high. Why should the commuter pay? I mean, we see these incredible profits that the oil companies are making. Why shouldn't they be paying out of their profits for doing things like finding better ways to fuel our cars?
Well, the oil companies are making a lot of money because Americans are demanding a lot of gasoline. They're buying the gasoline. And the fact that people are willing to buy so much gasoline at current prices tells me that the price isn't high enough. The oil companies need those profits in order to fund exploration for more oil in the future and also to build refineries. Now, they're not really building the refineries for a number of reasons, including environmental concerns, regulation, and the fact that a refinery is very, very expensive. But price is very important because the one nice thing about taxes is that they can affect behavior, and they're reflected in the price of a commodity. So if you want people to do more of something, you can simply make it cheaper and they'll do more of it. If you want them to do less of something, make it more expensive.
Which is what you're suggesting with what is in effect a tax.
That's right. I mean, almost everybody would agree that it's probably a good thing if we were to conserve gasoline. Well, the best way to do that is raise the price.
Well, and that might affect the companies in the long run because if people buy less, their profits will be less. So
absolutely.
If you're looking to hit them in the pocketbook, this might be one way to do it.
That's right. In fact, I've seen an email going around the internet recently arguing that we should all boycott gasoline for a day in order to hurt the oil companies.
By the way, May 15th is the day. That's, not that we've seen that email too, but and by the way, what do you think of that?
Oh, I think it's silly because, I mean, if you don't buy gasoline today, you'll just buy twice as much tomorrow.
What do you think of the idea? Some analysts are saying that the reason that gasoline keeps going back or remains at such a high price is that the industry has figured out that people are used to it. I mean, the first time it went over $3, it was shocking, and now it's not so shocking anymore.
That's absolutely true. In fact, I remember a couple of years ago, there were many economists who were predicting a recession if oil prices or gasoline prices went up too high, and they couldn't understand why this hasn't happened. But when you think about it, it makes sense. I mean, the average driver drives about maybe 12, 13,000 miles a year. If you assume they get about 20 miles to the gallon, they need to buy about 600 gallons of gasoline. Well, if gasoline costs a dollar more per gallon than a year ago, that's only $600 additional. The real cost of driving has to do with buying the car, insuring the car, maintaining the car. Gasoline is a very minor cost.
What if Americans just adjust to $5 a gallon and just keep buying as much? Does your plan not work?
Well, no, it will work. They will eventually adjust, but they'll make adjustments in their driving. They will start driving more efficient cars. I mean, you can't mandate. I'm not in favor of these CAFE regulations, for example, that say cars must get X miles per gallon. My plan says, well, raise the price of gasoline and people will demand cars that get better fuel economy.
There's been a lot of finger pointing in Congress. You mentioned the CAFE standards, which is what Democrats want. They want to demand that car makers increase fuel efficiency, as you said, make better cars, investigate oil company profits. What else is going on in Congress? What might we actually see come out of that finger-pointing?
Well, I think we are going to get higher CAFE standards. And like I said, I'm not necessarily in favor of those things. I am very much in favor of having more efficient cars, and I like the idea of having cars that get much better mileage. Nobody had to buy an SUV. But they bought an SUV because they made an economic decision. And that decision was that, you know, gasoline really isn't that expensive. It's not a major cost of driving. Therefore, I can afford to drive an SUV. But if the gasoline price is very high, they'll make smarter decisions.
And by the way, we should say, you're not normally a guy who likes taxes.
No, I'm not. In fact, I'm very opposed to taxes. But like I said, the one nice thing about taxes is that they affect behavior. And I'm very much in favor of using taxes to affect behavior.
Vahan Jinjigian, Vice President of the Forbes Investor Advisory Institute, speaking to us about the country's record high gas prices. How high do you think it will go this summer?
You know, I really don't think it's going to go much higher because we have seen oil prices slide back down a little bit. Refineries were producing at about 88% capacity, and I think they're going to start increasing production pretty soon. So I would expect to see capacity go over 90% relatively soon. And as a result, we should see gasoline prices actually slide back down to perhaps 270, 280 per gallon.
Vahan, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, still to come before we go, singer-songwriter Patty Griffin, she's known for her songs about people down on their luck, oh, the heartache, the hardship. Now she's out with what she calls her happy record. Well, it's all relative, as you'll see. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, you're going to feel the pinch of high gas prices on the road and in the air. The Department of Transportation says the average cost of a round-trip flight this summer will reach $378. That's the highest in 7 years. And travel experts say some fares that look like they're deals may not be. For instance, if you see a great fare advertised to Boston, it may actually arrive at what we here in New England refer to as Portsmouth, New Hampshire, 44 miles away. And those low fares start to cost more as airlines tack on fees for everything from fuel surcharge to curbside check-in. Take the new airline Skybus. They've shortened the legroom, cramming 156 passengers on a plane that normally carries 124. And the airline is charging for everything, from checked luggage to pillows and blankets. Joining us for more, Here Now's resident travel consultant, Khalil Sakakini of TravelVideoPostcard.com. Khalil, first of all, how inexpensive are these Skybus fares?
Skybus promises that all fares will be about a half as much as our standard legacy airline flight, with about 10 to 15 seats actually allocated for $10 to $50 a seat.
But then we start tacking on the fees. What is Skybus going to charge passengers for?
Well, they're going to charge for everything. First of all, they're going to save money, Robin, by having no call center. So you can't pick up the phone and say, gee, is my flight delayed? Or, listen, I screwed up. I don't really want to go here. I want to go there. So that saves them a lot of money. No call centers. Everything is done by web. Secondly, when you get to the gate, don't expect the gate attendant there until the very last minute. So there's nobody you can go to and say, hey, here's my ticket. Is everything okay? Because that's not going to happen.
Right. You're also going to have to pay for bags?
You're going to pay for every bag that you bring in. I think it's $5 for the first two and $50 for the additional bags. You're going to be paying for drinks. There's no sign to seat, but you can pay $10 for a priority boarding. You can pay X number of dollars for an aisle seat.
They also seem to be depending on connecting flights. Now, right. the Tacoma Washington News Tribune did a comparison. A flight from Tacoma to Boston on Alaska Airlines, it leaves from SeaTac Airport, just 20 miles outside Tacoma, flies direct to Boston's Logan, assigned seat, free snacks, $270. Skybus flight is $150 less, but you have to drive 122 miles to Bellingham to start your flight.
You do.
You get nothing on the flight. Right. You connect in Columbus, Ohio, which adds 3 hours. Arrive in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, 44 miles outside Boston, which is great if you're going to New Hampshire. Right. But for that $150 less, do you think people are really going to go for that inconvenience?
Maybe not that particular flight, Robin, but I think travel has become a commodity. It's like soybeans. It's like dry goods. What is driving the consciousness is I want to get from point A to point B, and I want to get there as cheaply as possible. Maybe that particular flight doesn't justify taking this particular airline, but maybe other flights do. The whole concept of low-cost, ultra-low-cost airlines is I am willing to sacrifice service to get to where I want to go at the cheapest flight. Now, there'll be a breaking point to which people will say, this is too much. I don't want to be a soybean. I don't want to be a canned good. I do want some vestige of service. But that jury's out yet. I'm not sure people really want service in lieu of price.
Well, many travel writers are already complaining about Skybus. You mentioned you can buy all your food. You are not allowed to bring on food or drink from the outside. And travel writers are saying that's food extortion. Paying for preferred seating or being able to get on ahead of everybody else is a form of bribery. But are there airlines going to follow suit?
Well, we already think that they are. I mean, Spirit Airlines started the whole thing by charging $1 for soda and $1 for water. And Allegiant, which flies to Las Vegas and Orlando and Tampa, is charging for beverages, charging for assigned seats, charging for bags. I think some wag once said, look, why don't we just simply have a pay-for-fuel purchase deal? So in other words, the person buys the amount of fuel they need, they get from point A to point B. Well, I don't think that's extreme, but I think airlines are watching very closely. The sense is that we need revenues, people want low prices, so they may push the envelope as far as it can go, and when and if there's a backlash, then that's going to be a problem.
Well, we'll see how that unfolds.
Amen.
Khalil Sakakini, content editor of TravelVideoPostcard.com. Thanks as always.
My pleasure as always.
Give me a ticket for an airplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. I don't care how much money I gotta spend. Got to get back to my baby again. Lonely days are gone, I'm a going home. My baby just wrote me a letter.
Just ahead, singer-songwriter Patty Griffin, Here and Now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now. Patty Griffin's songs are stories of a world in motion. Her new CD, Children Running Through, follows characters as they drive cars, ride buses, chase trains, ride on the back of a horse.
She started with us on the back of a horse, just 17 and already divorced.
In the world of Patty Griffin, people flee heartache and climb mountains.
I went up to the mountain because you asked me to. Up over the clouds to where the sky was blue.
Even the critics who love Patty Griffin, and there are many, joke about how melancholy her songs are as they're sung in a clear-as-a-bell soprano.
Sometimes I feel like I've never been nothing but tired. And I'll be working till the day.
We're lucky enough to have Patty Griffin joining us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. Great to be here.
And nice to see you. And having read just recently many reviews, are you all right?
I'm very all right.
Yeah, big smile.
This is my happy record.
Well, let's talk about that. For instance, yeah. The Washington Post writes, exquisite lyrics, marvelous concert that they reviewed, rich catalog, they love you. And write, nothing makes you happier than sounding disconsolate. Is that?
I just did a show there, and I went through a big long pile of really sad songs by myself in the middle of it, and I kind of just made a little joke about it.
You told a story about I think this was that concert that you and a songwriter were talking to each other, a friend of yours, and you realized, oh my gosh, we have no happy songs.
Yeah.
Who was the songwriter, by the way?
It's my friend Craig Ross.
Right. And then you played one that you said was is this the song that was the happy song?
Burgundy Shoes is my first happy song, I think.
Let's listen.
Bus driver smiles a dime and a nickel. Climb on our seats, the vinyl is cold. Michelle, my bell, a song that you love, then you hold my hand and sing to yourself. Sun, sun.
Now, it's not a, Jumping with Glee but tell us about that song. What is that?
Trying to sort of come up with a moment in my memory of what happiness felt like, and I went back to being very small and waiting for the bus with my mom to go to, I grew up in Old Town, Maine, and the big city where my grandmother lived was Bangor, Maine.
Oh boy.
And we would get on the bus and go there, and nothing felt better in growing up in New England, a kid in New England, when you could take those big boots off your feet and put your shoes back on. And I think that's probably where I became a really big fan of shoes.
We should explain, you did grow up in Old Town, Maine. It's a place famous for making boats and canoes. It's landlocked, though. It's surrounded by rivers, but mm-hmm. landlocked. And mud season lasts, for about 8 months a year.
Yeah.
So is that what you mean, that you got to...
I was finally, you just feel like you're flying. The boots are heavy and the shoes are light.
It was a part of it, too. I mean, at that point, flying only from Old Town to Bangor, which isn't
that great,
but leaving Maine, yearning to leave Maine.
When you grow up in Maine, you have this really strange, at least when I was there, there's so little to do in the economics of the place. Don't leave a lot of room for it. Diversity and work. Mm-hmm. And so I lived in Boston for about 10 years waiting on tables trying to get the music going. I finally got a record deal and I said, well, great, I'm going to go back to Maine now. And I did, and I couldn't really make my way into the community there because I was always leaving town. So you always want to go back, but it doesn't always work out.
How did Maine inform you?
Well, I think the cold and the perseverance and that sort of living, hard living, poor people. It's what I'm made of, and it's feeds my work.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, some of the phrases that pop up, you know, sitting on vinyl covered chairs, the cool of a vinyl chair.
Yeah.
As opposed to a Smith and Hawken, that struck me. Just that phrase, a vinyl covered chair.
Vinyl's cold, yeah.
Yeah, vinyl's cold, yeah. Well, your songs have been recorded by Bette Midler, Jessica Simpson, the Dixie Chicks. This is your fifth studio album. Emmylou Harris has also recorded your songs, and she's featured on the song Trapeze. We heard a tiny bit of it at the top. Let's hear a little more.
Some people want to know what it feels like to fly.
We don't want to leave people with the impression that you are always so somber.
No.
You have a sort of rocking song on this new CD. Everybody's saying it's the Dylan-esque song, Getting Ready.
That's so funny. To me, it's like Iggy Pop, but it's cool that people are saying Dylan. That's funny.
And tell us more about the Iggy Pop nature of it. What would you call that, punk?
Yeah, it's just intense, you know, thrashing the guitar, silly kind of. I love Iggy's, to me, his magic is in how silly he could be and fun. And, you know, I know he cut himself on stage early on, but I think basically his songs are, they have,
Yahoo.
They're really, really, really funny. And that's what I love about him, and I sort of was inspired by him when I wrote that song. So that's interesting. I just heard that Dylan thing too.
I know all the magic's gone. Wish I had a magic wand.
Well, and we also want to offer congratulations. We hear that a new play based on your music is now in pre-production. It's called 10 Million Miles.
Right.
What is it about, and how involved are you in it?
You know, I'm not very involved at all. I was approached by a playwright named Keith Bunin quite a few years ago, and I've never really had the time to sit down with him and do that. And he ended up piecing together a play around pre-existing and unrecorded material. And then I wrote a couple of things at the tail end. And it's really exciting. I don't have a lot of background with the Broadway world or that sort of genre. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't try.
Can you give us just a, you know, quick story synopsis? Or
It's sort of a road trip. So a young poor couple, working class couple on a road trip. Somebody's pregnant and they don't really know what to do. And,
of course they are.
Yeah.
It's a Patty Griffin.
Yeah.
It sounds great. Well, we want to leave, and we have been sort of giving you a little whatever about not writing the cheery song. So let's end, shall we, with No Bad News.
Yeah.
Just because there is so much bad news, maybe we can make believe. Right. Patty Griffin, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
For more on Patty's touring schedule and on the CD Children Running Through, go to our website, here-now.org.
Why don't you burn it all down, burn your own house down, burn your own house down, try to cure your own disease. And leave the rest of us, there's a lot of us, leave the rest of us who want to live in peace, to live in peace.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.